Friday. We're going to go ahead and get started.
No, can't we keep talking about our
I know, right? It's a very relaxed afternoon, which is actually wonderful. That'll be okay. We're doing just information this evening, so we should be fine with that. We don't have folks from our executive committee, so there's not a whole lot of that I'll need to do, but we'll just go through. Approve the minutes from the last meeting in June to be in your packets.
You only have quorum, right?
We have quorum.
Just have to pass.
I guess we approved them in September.
We have quorum, actually.
Okay, move approval.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Any discussion? Okay, the minutes are approved. Is there anybody, I don't think that we have anybody signed up for public testimony, but I'm just going to call it out just in case. Okay. Matthew has a quick announcement before the director's update.
Good afternoon, everyone. I just wanted to let folks know that Dyke Dame and Betty Dominguez have submitted their letters of resignation to PHAC. They wanted us to convey that to you all, that they've had Betty with her work with Metro, and Dyke, I think, is getting ready to wrap things up professionally. It's just ready for them to transition off. They've been on for some years, and they've appreciated working with all of you. And so we're currently sitting at 3 vacancies, so at some point we'll be having a conversation about new membership once again. So that's also why we have quorum right now.
Lily, how many members do we have right now?
10 members. So.
Any given yeah, move?
Amy, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to make an announcement to everyone. I too have to step down because I was offered my dream job of my lifetime that I've worked really hard for. So I'll be working as a forensic peer specialist with Cascadia's fact team, and that will keep me busy Monday through Friday. So unfortunately, I won't be able to stay on. Much as I love this place, I have other work to do now. Mm-hmm. So thank you all for your support, and it's been wonderful. I'm going to miss you guys.
Congratulations, Amy.
Congratulations. Yeah. That's awesome.
And thank you for your service, Amy. You've been with us for a number of years. We really appreciate it.
All right.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Welcome to August. Member PHAC. So we have included Jesse Connor. A brief update to you. Is that in the packet today, or was that already?
It should be the third item. The
okay.
Room.
Sorry, the meeting minutes are a little in there. So, thank you, Stacy, for all the meeting minutes that you talked about for us, by the way. So with that, you'll have a few of the ordinances that we have going to council or that relate to us. I will update you. So we have another multi-project, yay! I should say inclusionary zoning project, and this is the portion that council approves, which is the 10-year tax exemption in exchange for 99 years of affordability. So we'll be bringing on 5 additional units at 80% MFI. This will join our more than 200 inclusionary units that we have in process since the adoption of inclusionary zoning. The effective date of inclusionary zoning last February. The Water Bureau is actually bringing the next ordinance on this list, which is a transfer of property to the Portland Housing Bureau. It is a property on Syracuse, bordering kind of the railroad tracks, undeveloped parcel of land, about 3 acres, that we intend to develop 50 to 70 new homes on. This is actually a result of a council policy passed, I think, 3 years ago that gave a first right of refusal, essentially, to the Housing Bureau for affordable housing for any surplus land that any other bureau may be surplusing, which means they would put up for sale. So this is our second property that we've been able to acquire that way. The first was a Parks Bureau property on Mount Tabor at 60th and I'm trying to remember if it's Stark or Belmont.
Stark.
Stark, thank you. So we're very excited about that, and that's actually coming, and we have a date now, and that date is August 22nd, so it's a little earlier than we expected. And this week, we will also be joining our partners with at the Bureau of Transportation as they talk about the planning for the Division Corridor Rapid Transit, and talking about the commitments that the Housing Bureau has made and the progress that we've made on those commitments even before the transit line is actualized. You'll see there are other public meetings that we have this month, and then some funding updates. This month we actually had, as you hopefully already know, we released a NOFA, our summer 2018 NOFA. Doesn't mean we release one every quarter or every season, it just happens we name them when we actually release them. And in your packet you have a one-page sheet that describes the what is in the NOFA this year. I'll actually start with the bottom. So we have Central Eastside Urban Renewal Area funding, approximately $5.5 million. We have been holding on to these funds for quite some time. We initially planned on pairing them with the Clinton Triangle development, which is a Water Bureau property that is owned by, jointly by the Water Bureau and the Fire Bureau. We still intend on working on that property with the Fire Bureau and the Water Bureau in the future, but it is many years out because they need to find other locations, especially for the activity on the Fire Bureau. Do you guys know where the Clinton Triangle is I'm referring to? So it's a little odd triangular shaped parcel that is on inner southeast on Powell, and it's right where the light rail intersects with the train. And
do they have their training tower there?
Yes.
Yeah. They're getting rid of that one.
Well, they're not getting rid of it, but the plan is to redevelop that area. The reality is that they're going to need additional funding to move the activities that they have there. Their training has long been in East Portland. They still do have that kind of, it's a hollowed out tower that they would use to pretend fire training, you know, to climb up and things like that. But the reality is that this money is sitting in Central Eastside Industrial or Urban Renewal Area, and it's not gaining any more money. I mean, it's not making money, it's just sitting there, and we're losing buying potential. So we feel there's some opportunities in the district, and the time is now to put it out. We also are putting out $7 million in federal home funds. This is available anywhere, to be used anywhere in the city. We believe we're going to see a minimum of 60 new affordable units, and we would be, as we have in the past, our assumption is that 5% of those units can be supported at 0 to 30 without additional rent subsidy. And we are also requesting that 5% of the units be available if we have service funding for our permanent supportive housing. And then the larger portion of the NOFA is actually funding that is a joint capital and services funding. So the city is contributing $10 million in funding. The Oregon Housing and Community Services is committing $2 million in capital funding from their mental health housing fund. And the Joint Office of Homeless Services and Multnomah County Mental Health and Addiction Services are contributing $350,000 a year for service funding. Our intent with this project is to create an innovative strategy to start to really address some of the supportive housing crisis that we're seeing lack of supportive housing crisis that we're seeing playing out with our chronic homeless population, and try to pilot some ways to address that, especially with the adult single population. So we are asking for proposals that would bring a new model of what we call SRO, or single room occupancy. So smaller units, not necessarily with all of the plumbing and kitchens or bathrooms that you would see with a studio, but they may be combined in some kind of communal living space. We're not being prescriptive on that, but we're asking for some thoughts from the development community as they work on their NOFAs. We are doing a lot of work on the proposals. We're doing a lot of work with our partners at the county on supportive housing. And one of the things, you know, we're learning about different types of models that may be most effective, especially when dealing with a population that needs mental health services to be supported in their, and successful in their housing. That's really what this is directed at. Amy?
Yeah, I was curious if anyone had any thoughts about the Oxford-style housing options, because they have been very successful for many, many decades, and it encourages people to grow. So, you know, that would be a phenomenal opportunity if money could be set aside to develop more Oxford-style living for folks with addictions and mental health in a real supportive environment. Now, it was my understanding that shared housing wasn't permitted. Has that changed?
Shared housing?
Like in a housing environment, or not necessarily in a building, apartment building, but like apartments or housing in like a house where I thought it was like HUD had restricted, it was two people to a one-bedroom unit was what I had heard previously. Has that changed as far as living together, you know, folks living together in
like
a shared environment?
The maximum amount of people per unit?
Yeah, it was two people per one bedroom, was my understanding.
I think that's probably the same, Amy. This is not federal funding that we're using. This is actually city-specific funding, but we would not intend, our intention would not be that these units would house potentially more than one or two folks at most, and likely more one individual. We do think that we would be seeing, we think it's likely that we could see unit proposals as small as 12 units. We know that for what we're seeing in terms of success both in Multnomah County and in other areas is that smaller configurations for supportive housing are working, where you may have someone who's living there full time. It's a model that we would potentially expect to see submitted under this pilot. So it is potential, we do have the potential of funding many buildings, many smaller size buildings, but you know, it's an area that we have not done funding specifically we've not specifically directed our capital in this way with the type of funding we're seeing for the services. And we are trying to allow our partners to provide us with what they think is the right solution for this mix. And so we're trying to be a little less prescriptive. If you actually read the NOFA, you'll find that we did not call out 0 to 30 specifically, though that is what we're intending to do. What we're trying to achieve is rents that are less than $500 a month that can be sustained and sustain the building in the long term without rent support. And so our expectation is, quite frankly, that we will have to, our cost per unit in terms of what we fund will be higher, that the cost per unit would be lower than we normally see because of the smaller sized unit. But we are expecting that we'll have to contribute more funds than we normally would to make this a sustainable model.
A couple questions. Is mixed use permitted?
Certainly. We would not be funding the commercial portion of that.
No, I'm just trying, when you start talking about subsidies, I'm thinking about internal subsidies as well. So that second question I had is, so is there a correlation between the 350,000 and the 50 units? I don't know what that number would be today, but is that enough to do the right thing for 50 units?
Yes. And I apologize for not remembering the ratios right now.
Okay.
$7,000. So we're projecting about $7,000 a year of support.
Okay.
And if for some reason an applicant had service funding from another area, we're also open to using that funding for operating support if that's what would make the building pencil out.
Okay.
So we want to be flexible with this. We
right.
know we're trying to do something somewhat new in the community, and so we want to be able to open opportunity for folks to tell us what would work for them. But we, as you know, we do have a goal of achieving 2,000 units of supportive housing in the next 10 years.
Right. So that links up with the other question I had, which is down in the home project.
Mm-hmm.
I made a note, I think this is what you said, must be permanent supportive housing if we have the service funding.
Mm-hmm.
So would you perhaps reassign, if I did have other sources for services, would that be committed maybe to the home PSH?
Well, if
or
some,
does it go float out?
If someone doesn't need the money for the services that they're operating, we will be looking at their proposal, yeah. And we would not use that if it weren't necessary, but we want to put out the maximum amount. We believe we have a year to support that.
Yeah.
So ideally, sure, if someone could make a proposal where yeah. that they didn't either need operating support well, or that, they didn't need the services.
I guess that's the thing, is like if you wind up having operating, maybe competing with the 5% on the home program because you don't have the money.
Right. Right.
Yeah, okay. So I want to make sure I understood. And one other quick question. This came up at a meeting the other day, and I don't remember exactly, but we used to have, I thought, a receivership program for transferred properties. Maybe it was zombie homes or something. And it went to nonprofits directly. And now apparently there's a city attorney or somebody who's saying that it doesn't. Anyway, the goal is to get it to nonprofits to do the right thing. But maybe I'm wrong. Don't we already have the ability to transfer? I know the county does. But doesn't the city also have the ability to take crummy houses and put them in receivership and give them to nonprofits?
I actually did a deep dive on this with Mayor Charlie Hill's team back a year and a half or more ago, and it's a really difficult program to administer. We researched it pretty thoroughly, and now the state, I think we're going right. to be taking something to the legislature right. to see whether or not we can fix a problem. It hasn't been working, and it's got some serious flaws.
Okay.
Yeah, and Nancy, I think I would echo, I think, and maybe worked on a different part of the issue, but, you know, taking someone's home by a foreclosure action
right.
is something that the city has been hesitant to do for
right.
a long period of
right.
time. They are just starting to put more sideboards on that and parameters right. of that through the auditor's office. But one of the things that we did explore, because we explored the city taking them or passing them to nonprofits, quite frankly, by the time the city is would be taking a home in foreclosure for that reason, they are not worth taking.
They're teardowns.
Yeah, and so I think the question is you know, do we have any, if we can work out a program, is there indeed funding to essentially wipe the,
right.
you know, wipe it out? Because
right.
there's not much value at that point.
Yeah.
Our conclusion partly was, why take the worst case scenario and try to turn it into affordable housing when you actually could spend a whole lot less money and using what's out, assets that are in much better condition than zombie homes.
Okay.
Let's see.
Since you're pausing for just
sure,
a minute,
sure.
Shannon, do you mind if I'm going to take you back to the Water Bureau property.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what the plan for that is? I mean, the Partners for Affordable Homeownership still connect and communicate, and I'm sure we'd be interested in what the plan is for building
sure.
homeownership units there.
So if you wouldn't mind, I will do one quick note, and
okay.
then I'll explain a little bit of that when I'm going to talk about something quickly. And I think I'm taking up too much time.
You're okay. Where
okay.
he's... not here yet, I think.
Okay.
Ryan is on in about 20 minutes.
So just to remind everybody, we did release preservation funding this year from a 2017 RFI, which was a request from our partners to let us know what they needed in terms of preservation, and then we ranked those accordingly. We also were beneficiaries in this region of some state funding for preservation, and so we tried to play off, the state did some, and we did some of the others. And we're excited about what we were able to provide for preservation funding. So although it's not as sometimes exciting as some of the newer projects, it's really essential to maintaining our portfolio in the long term. So I want to make sure that you're aware of that. And then I'm just going to give you a quick couple of updates about some of the other work that we're doing. And one of the things I wanted, and we'll have a deeper dive into this, but I think you should know about what we're doing or what we're proposing presently in the Interstate Urban Renewal Area. So we had a joint meeting of the City of Portland's North and Northeast Neighborhood Strategy Oversight Committee and the Prosper Portland Community Development Initiative to talk about the potential for increasing maximum indebtedness in the Interstate Urban Renewal Area. So the current maximum, there's some big numbers up there. The conversations we're having, and just to give you a little background, would be a substantial amendment to the urban renewal area. Existing plans cannot be increased by more than 20% of the area and may not be increased by more than 20% of the original maximum indebtedness unless approved by other taxing jurisdictions. So the current proposal that we're having community conversations about is to increase the, I'm going to skip this one, to increase the maximum indebtedness that would trigger a substantial amendment. So that means that there is a very prescribed statutory policy. This is really preliminary in the discussion, so I want you to just have an understanding that we are now beginning to have conversations that may end up with us moving to what would be a substantial amendment for urban renewal area, which would move us through a year-long process. So you'll hear more about this from us, but I don't want you to think if you hear about it that it's a done deal or it is just the beginning of the conversation. So we would do formal public input, we would prepare an amendment, we would, Prosper Portland would review, the Planning and Sustainability Commission would review, Multnomah County would be briefed, and then City Council hearing would happen. But well before we get to this, we're just starting a dialogue about what our intent is and seeing how the community feels about our proposal. So to let you know what we were proposing with that, as you know, the Housing Bureau would receive, in this district, it's our highest percentage of urban renewal funds, so we would be receiving for affordable housing work 70% of the funds if we were to increase maximum indebtedness. So we have currently are working on land banking opportunities in the district with our remaining funds that were unallocated and then filling gaps in projects. And what we propose to do, if we move forward at this time, at least for initial conversations, are four different things. And Diane, this is where the first little box here is actually the Cary Boulevard property. So the Water Bureau property is not currently in the urban renewal area, but is located very near. We would hope to bring that property within the urban renewal area, and we would hope to leverage funding from the urban renewal area to create 50 to 70 new homes. If we were to do that and we were to be included in the urban renewal area, these homes would be subject to the preference policy. So, Diane, other than that, we don't have a lot of thoughts about what we are presently thinking, but that's the thought for this property going forward. Otherwise, we'd be looking at other general citywide resources, and quite frankly, it would be a long time for us to be able to develop this property.
Okay. So you've got 50 to 70 units for 11.7 million. That's a much higher subsidy. Is that including?
We'd also be proposing to purchase the land.
Oh, okay. In that?
Yeah.
Okay. That makes better sense.
We also are thinking we'd have three other major projects out of the district with these funds. One we believe would be a rental project of approximately 50 units, just kind of as a general concept. The land banked project that you can see up above, the land we're trying to purchase right now in the district, we would want to develop that project. Whether that would be home ownership or rental, we don't know, but it is where we are thinking of trying to purchase land is actually, it would be a multifamily development. So it would, if it is home ownership, it would be something similar to a condo type model. And then we are projecting that we would have another $7.5 million for another major project. So this is, we're just trying to give a broad outline to what we think our work would be. We have quite a bit of funding continuing in the district over the next few years for home repair displacement prevention of existing homeowners that we do not feel that our proposal would not be to add resources to that at the present time. So that kind of was trying to give you a little background into that. And I know that we're starting to, am I in everybody else's time now?
Nope.
Well, one more follow-up.
Sure.
Sorry, is it okay? For
yes, please.
Because, you know, even with the $5 million for 65 preference policy homes, that's a lot less per
and that was not with land. So this is an expansion and, you know, broadening out, given the cost in the district for just how much it really takes to serve preference policy families. Is that the thinking behind, I mean, this is a big...
Oh, you mean about the amount of money?
Yeah.
I think we're also thinking about time, Diane. I mean, we're, you know, what, by when the amendment happened is when the money would be available. We're trying to project some idea of a future cost.
Well, maybe we can come up with some ideas.
Yes, and you know, I will tell you, this is all, you know, this is all, not to say all of it, but this is largely dependent upon this URA amendment going forward. So,
well, there's been some, you know, stress in the past around the city driving the URA conversations and how that affects other jurisdictions, certainly Multnomah County. So, there.
Yes, and you know, I don't have the numbers for you. I'm happy to provide those. We're digging more deeply into it, but. You know, over the life of the district and the time that we'd be extending it, the tax impact to the taxing jurisdictions is relatively minor. Quite frankly, in conversations that I've had with Director Branham at Prosper, this is really the only district, because of our goals in the district, that we would be recommending this. You know, there are no other districts at this time, that are current districts that we're thinking of extending, but because of what we still believe is a lot of the work left undone and commitments to the community, not in terms of hard goals, but commitments to the community in general. We feel like it's worthy of having a conversation about this tool and about how we use this tool. And it's a hard conversation because this is a tool that was used to displace, and we are now asking the community to use a tool that was used against them to mitigate those impacts. And you know, we have to own up to that as part of this conversation. And it is, you know, it is definitely going to be a conversation we have to have throughout this whole process.
Well, maybe some of us could help advocate with the other jurisdictions the impact this could have, particularly Multnomah County.
Just a quick question. The 20%, you could increase it by $67 million without the consent of other jurisdictions, right?
We could increase it below that amount. We're not proposing to. Victoria's looking at me. She knows. Victoria, am I answering that correctly?
Can you repeat the question?
I'm just trying to understand the case for doing more than 20%. I mean, everybody can use more money all the time. I'm not stupid, but. If you're pushing against other jurisdictions going beyond 20%, $67 million seems like a lot, but it's not as much as $200 million. But have you looked at whether the more than 20% is absolutely, definitely the right thing to do?
I think that the laws prohibit us beyond 20%. I think 20% is as high as we are able to go.
So Ramsey, I think that we could definitely ask for less funding and not hit the public process.
Right.
You know, honestly, hitting six, you know, I think there's a question too, is if we're gonna do this, we may as well have the conversation with a substantial amendment, and to have that full fleshed out discussion. I mean, I will be frank with you that at some point, whether you're going a million under, you need to have the full conversation. And you know, maybe after all of this, whether we move forward with this or not, we hear from the community, that's not the level we want you to be at. But
right.
We want to be clear as to what we do if we hit that substantial amendment amount about that.
I guess the follow-up question would be, what is the scale? What would the ask be if it's more than the 20%? Do we have a number of what that ask would be?
We would not be asking for, this is the maximum that we'd be asking for.
So the 67 is the maximum.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
There's a different, the trigger for this, so the, make sure I'm saying this, the maximum is $67 million under state law, given the original interstate corridor plan
right.
and urban renewal area.
Right.
I don't know where the line is. We can get back to you on where between 0 and 67 the substantial amendment hits. So it's somewhere between 0 and 67. Prosper could give us that exact dollar amount. that would be classified as a substantial and require the public process, but under no circumstances can we go beyond the
67 million.
Okay. But so in other words, just for, you could be at 28 today, but you could go to 67 if you had a substantial amendment.
Right, there's some dollar amount where you won't trigger the substantial.
Well, on its face, it is just as advice on the team, take it or leave it always, it seems like we really should go for as much as possible, legally possible, because I think the other jurisdictions have a hand in this crisis too and might really want to use this as a tool in this really difficult time in this very important neighborhood. So, go for it.
So, and then quickly, I know we're going over and we have guests. I just wanted to announce, if you already haven't seen it, the fourth identified Housing Bureau bond property. We now have identified one property that we, before I go to that, let me just say this is on Northeast Prescott. It's in the Culley neighborhood. We believe it can handle about 50 to 70 households or homes, depending on the configuration. We don't have plans for the configuration yet. We'll start a community conversation, but we did just purchase the property. It is the home of a lovely family. Presently, it is a one single family home. We're in contact with them. We were early. They know that they can stay throughout this process, and we're going to work with them before the development happens. But we are really excited about this opportunity.
They're renters.
They are. Okay. They are. They will have relocation rights under the Oregon Relocation Act that exceed what the cities are, but we also wanted to assure them more than just a paper notice. So we've had, not myself, but our staff has had numerous conversations making sure that they're comfortable and have a time period. We're also making sure we're doing the needed repairs to make it safe for them right now, lead paint renewal and encapsulation, that type of thing while they're still remaining in the home. So
for those of you who are counting,
that brings, as I said, four bond projects, two for new development, one at 30th and Powell. This will join that, as you know, the Ellington, and then the 105th and Burnside, which will be is a brand new building we'll be leasing up shortly. And with that, I will cede my time.
Wonderful to make progress on these bond projects, given that we're really working very hard to the Metro bond on top of it, so thank you.
He's in the Tribune about it today, too.
I missed that. I hope it's a good piece.
Old habits.
Should I miss it? Should I read it later?
No, they just took the press release.
Okay.
So we are just running a few minutes behind. I know that we have a guest, but we do have one more standing agenda item, and that is to leave some time for open discussion amongst the commissioners. If there are some topics that anyone would like to raise.
I got a quick one. Bureau assignments?
Yeah.
I was told yesterday, but has it happened?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. It's a quick one. You're told me it
too. Huh? I will tell you, I hear constant rumors about bureau assignments.
Right.
But I'm not really paying much attention to those.
Right.
If that gives you an indication of what I think is going to happen, at least for the Housing Bureau. So.
Anything from any other commissioners?
Oh, are we going to talk about this? We're going to do the presentation and then come back to our general participatory process?
If you have some questions about that, that would be great. I didn't put it as a item to go over, but we can certainly discuss it.
Did this address some of the issues we talked about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so talking about the participatory practices document. I was on the work group that worked with Jesse to put it together, and I feel really good about it. And it sounds like the former Oni is coming. The bureau, formerly known as Oni, is developing some additional guidelines for all of the public and the advisory commissions for all the bureaus. So we probably more to come.
Yeah,
on this.
That's a really good point. So formerly Oni, now the Office of Community and Civic Life. had the moment that we started this work, they let us know that there was a resolution that passed the city council, and so there will be some, they're setting some uniform standards for all of the advisory bodies at all of the bureaus and departments across the city. So we'll be waiting for those, and some of those address some of the issues that were raised in the work group, like term limits, roles and responsibilities, just some things that really get into some details that I wanted to have a good use of the group's time and not have to repeat a bunch of work if we were going to need to go back again. So at the moment, let's see, I got an email from them that hopefully soon-ish is the response that I got. So hopefully we get those that information in the next week or two, and we'll see what that looks like internally, and then reach out to all of you to see how to move forward with that.
Thank you.
So related to that, and what Matt shared earlier about us losing a couple of members, I think it would be great if we had a few minutes at, I guess, at an upcoming meeting to talk about kind of what skill sets and experience we are losing from our commission with the folks who are stepping down, and if we could maybe come up with some ideas for the commissioner in charge of the bureau to... for the mayor, in terms of what skills and experiences we think the body could benefit from as we're recruiting new members.
Absolutely, yeah. And one reason I've also been holding off on doing recruitment from some of our former members is that is also a piece of the resolution that will be coming down. So I also didn't want to get halfway through the recruitment process and then be told, actually, you have to do it this way. But yes, that is a great idea to include that, so we can kind of, although there will be, I've been told there'll be guidelines on what recruitment looks like, they definitely wanted to allow, since there are, I think, 150-ish bodies, that we will need to be able to, yeah, it's quite a lot, customize that to the work that we do, and so I think that's an excellent suggestion. All right, Ryan and Matthew, if you're ready.
To that point, and this is an update and a briefing and then a discussion, so to the extent you want to discuss to the end, you can. There's no action or request being put in front of you, but at the end of the discussion you may have some self-determination to do so and take action. So I'm Ryan Curran with the City of Portland's Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, project manager for the Southwest Corridor Equitable Housing Strategy. You should have the handout in front of you, and I'm going to walk through some of the background and analysis and then some of the recommendations that we're making, but want to kind of zoom back and give you some context for kind of the origination, the origins of this project and kind of who the partners are and what's the scope. So some of you all may know that there is a light rail line being planned along the Southwest Corridor. I'll give you a little bit of detail about that, but just to say that as the City of Portland City Council was looking at how to participate in that planning process during the, I think it was almost during the first month of the housing emergency, the Transportation Bureau had gone to the council and asked for funds to participate in planning, and they said, well, if when you do come back with a locally preferred alternative for the light rail, bring a housing strategy with it. We want to learn from lessons from the past and get ahead of some of the speculative market pressures and displacement. So the Planning Bureau and the Transportation Bureau took that direction and applied for some funds from Metro to do some planning in the corridor, and in doing so reached out to the city of Tigard. So you'll see there's a Tigard seal on the cover of the strategy. So this is a housing strategy that covers both Portland and Tigard. We also reached out to the Housing Bureau to request partnership in this effort, so co-developing the strategy with the Housing Bureau, the Planning Bureau, and the City of Tigard's Community Development Department specifically. So those are the partners that kind of got together to launch this effort. Where's the button? There we go. The Corridors Light Rail Project has just wrapped up its environmental impact statement process. So lots of comments made by community and different organizations and institutions, including the Planning and Sustainability Commission. Their letter is being transmitted to you after this meeting. I'll send you a copy of that. It has some really specific housing analysis critiques of the DEIS. The locally preferred alternative is being presented to the steering committee for the Light Rail Project on Monday. And they will vote on that, and then different jurisdictions will take action on that locally preferred alternative. The City of Portland's action is scheduled for October 10th. And so we sequenced this housing strategy to go in front of City Council October 3rd. So there's an October 3rd resolution Council will consider to adopt a housing strategy, and then they will take action on the light rail project on the following week. We also have a council work session on both on September 4th. So those are the kind of the three moments where council will weigh in on the totality of the work going into the corridor. There is the preferred route from staff on the screen in front of you. The points I'd make about this are that the station locations and the alignment have a good potential for development. There was an intent to take it off of the highway and really create opportunities along Barber to align with the Barber concept plan, which is a city adopted plan 2013 to allow for community development and make a more walkable and livable place along the corridor. So with that comes opportunity for affordable housing, an opportunity for other community uses that alignment along the I-5 just would not have. So the lack of affordable housing and the displacement pressures in the corridor are a problem. I'll show you some of the analysis we did that kind of gave a quantitative view of that, and also walk you through the community partners engagement that showed the kind of the qualitative side to it all. So we're expanding this transit system, this region-wide transit system, in the middle of a housing crisis, right? So this long-term plan in the middle of a current day crisis. So we had an eye toward how are you addressing this near-term crisis as well as the long-term need, and that there's a lot of tensions there about early investment versus later investment. So love to have a discussion about that. But what's clear is that the current housing crisis and the lack of transportation options in the corridor are really hindering people's quality of life in the area. Both rise to the level of a barrier for that folks are experiencing, both in terms of commute and having to drive and the cost of transit to just and all the housing issues that they're experiencing that you are more familiar with. So, and the growth occurring in the corridor is keeping up with citywide trends, and we expect at least another 3,000 households to be moving into the corridor over the next 10 years, regardless of whether the light rail occurs or not. So redevelopment is occurring. We'll give you some statistics on whether that's occurring in existing buildings versus new development, but it's going to continue. And so good portions of this housing strategy are quite relevant regardless of whether we're doing light rail. The transit kind of premium or impact to development feasibility is real and will just exacerbate that. I hit it all. Just so you know who all the players are, here's as simple as we could get it, the governance structure for the transit planning process and the equitable development planning. So one thing I didn't mention is that, I mentioned the steering committee and all the work going into the transit planning. The housing work group that we convened solely focused on housing, but we're nesting that within, Metro got a almost $1 million FTA grant to do an equitable development strategy. So while the housing got a head start, there's a whole more comprehensive group looking at housing in addition to workforce and economic development. So that work will continue over the next year and be hosted by Metro. Many of our advisory group members kind of were absorbed into that oversight committee, so the housing work that you see before you will stay intact and probably just be fleshed out and more advanced at the end of the next year. But we're already focusing on implementation. We'll share some of that with you, but note that planning never stops. That was the takeaway I had from this work, including on the light rail project. They're doing station optimization studies where some of the stations may shift, what you see before you may not be what it looks like when it goes in front of voters. I didn't mention that. It'll go in front of voters in 2020 for the local share of the transit project, and then looking at a federal application for funding in 2022. If everything went smoothly, then 2027 would be when light rail opened. So we would open. And so we designed this housing strategy to be a 10-year housing strategy from 2019 to 2029. So the vast majority of work is upfront and before transit even occurs, because we know that's when a lot of decisions are already made about land and development. So here's a little some of the highlights from the housing and equity needs analysis we did in the corridor.
Before we do that, are there any? Can I just see that? Mm-hmm. Are there any questions about the light rail portion and transit portion that Ryan and I can try to answer before we get into the housing specific analysis and strategy?
I was just curious. This is not an urban renewal district, right?
Correct.
So there's no funding where. For an affordable housing strat, maybe that comes with the next section.
It'll be with the next
section. Okay, sorry, I'm just curious. Okay. Oh, and one other thing is, I thought maybe Metro or other people were trying, so this is public information at this, obviously you wouldn't be showing this, so people know that this is the route that's being considered, therefore could it drive costs up along the corridor and create a huge debate about which alternative route might be out there.
So Metro did issue their draft environmental impact statement, which has the potential route options. So I can't speculate as to what market actors are doing, but it is out there and they're taking feedback. Okay. And as Ryan said, in August, the steering committee will identify what their locally preferred alternative is, and then that will go to the respective city councils for their official vote. But so it's already out there in the draft environmental impact statement that we did Metro and TriMet issue that. Mm-hmm. No, when? Do you remember when?
It was a 30-day comment period that ended in July 30th, so June 30th, I would say.
Yeah.
This summer. Related quick one, Ryan, in the key findings, it said buildings are selling quickly. Do we have any sense of that, any kind of objective data? I mean, this is what we all worry about, is after 2 years of planning, you know, all the properties are three times what they were a year ago.
It's in this next set of slides.
Okay, cool.
What's the anticipated year of the transit opening?
2027, best case scenario.
Yeah.
Better money.
Yeah, a vote, public vote and a federal application are both.
Right.
And cities, all the cities adopting the local liberal term, then those are the three big kind of make or break moments.
Okay, so turning toward the housing strategy and the analysis of the households that are currently in the corridor, you can see here on the slides, I'm not going to go through the statistics one by one, but the general takeaway is that there is growing racial diversity in the corridor, and there are well-established communities of color and communities in the corridor that through this process have very much expressed to the city of Tigard and the city of Portland a very real concern, just generally, regardless of the light rail line, but exacerbated by the potential light rail line, of rising housing costs, rising housing instability, and concerns about being displaced again. Many were displaced to this area and have established a community, and now there's a fear of being displaced again. So as part of the process, and I will walk through this table because I do think it's important, we tried to assess what the existing housing need is and projecting what the future housing need would be with growth projections in the corridor. So we looked specifically at households that were paying more than 50% of their income on housing, so extremely rent burdened, not just rent burdened, but extremely rent burdened households. As you can see, you have both Portland and Tigard in this table. And so for renters, there's a total Portland need of around 1,800 households in need of their pay, that are extremely rent burdened and would benefit for some sort of housing affordability or housing stabilization assistance, and 1,100 homeowners that may need some sort of home repair services or other sort of counseling services or foreclosure services.
Others Washington County.
To know there's the potential that the rail line can go all the way into Washington County and Tualatin, so depending on the designation. So if you look at the future need, you'll see both Portland and Tigard there. We can't necessarily project whether it's going to be renters or owners, but we imputed what we anticipated the total need would be by MFI category. Based on the projected growth in households, 3,000 households, that 2,200 of them, if you're looking at the household income makeup in the city currently, of the 3,000 would be in need of services, whether that's rental housing services or home ownership, home repair services would depend on what tenure the those 3,000 make up, and then what tenure the 2,200 make up.
Yeah, I think another piece that could be added for the full housing need is if right now this many renters are paying more than 50% of their income on housing, that means there are other renters that aren't yet paying 50% of their income on housing but likely will be if rents keep going up. And so that seems like that should be part of the future affordable housing need, is the people who aren't yet rent burdened but due to rising rents will become rent burdened if their incomes don't keep up with,
sure,
with rising rents.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So looking at what's going on the cost side, similar to the rest of the city and the rest of the region, we've seen housing costs continue to rise, although I would note, as you can see up there, that the asking rent in the Southwest Corridor is more expensive than the city overall, as well as the region overall, but the average is higher than the city overall. It is not the most expensive neighborhood, but it's higher than the city average. To the question about building transactions, so I'm going to kind of walk folks through this graph a little bit. So the yellow bars is a comparison of the effective rent per unit. And as you can see, it's been increasing from 2010 to 2017 from just over $1,000 to $1,400 per month. We'd ignore the gray, that's the asking rent, it's very, very close to the effective rent. And the orange is the average per unit sales price for the existing housing and how it's transacting in the market. As you can see, it's gone from $50,000 per unit up to $200,000 per unit on average. So we're seeing not only rents increase, but we're seeing the price per unit for these the market transactions go up. Overall, BPS contracted with PSU, Dr. Lisa Bates, to do an analysis of the naturally occurring affordable housing and just the housing market transactions generally in the Southwest Corridor. You can see there's 327 buildings with over 11,000 unregulated affordable homes. Two-thirds of the sales that have been going on over this time frame are located in the lower income areas where there is higher racial diversity, so higher concentration of communities of color. So this activity is happening. It's similar to what we're seeing across the city overall, but it is very much present in the Southwest Corridor.
Matthew, may I ask, just before we go back to that, could you give us a little clarity just in terms of where we see Portland on here versus the rest of them?
Mm-hmm. Where is the city limit between us and Tangerine?
And you know, maybe a major road, as you can see, there's a lot of housing. Okay.
That L-shape.
So this right here, this is the border of the city of Portland. So you see here that the darker orange is a higher neighborhoods with a higher concentration of communities of color, and then the points are the transactions in either 2006 through 16, or the yellow, if you can see them, are the 2017 transactions.
And that road, do you know what that road is? I mean, it's obviously a road that's going up that way with all of the apartments going
along. Right here?
No, the other way. I'm sorry, to the
left. Oh, here?
Yeah, thanks.
I do not know what road that is, Ryan. Do you know what road that is?
26.
Yeah,
it's
probably 26. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Not that far from here.
Probably, yeah, given what's going on along there.
Yeah.
So do we know if there's a correlation between the transactions of buildings and displacement or rent increases? Is that fueling displacement more than just kind of the natural growth in rents?
Well, we don't have evidence to be able to make the link empirically, but we do know that a lot of the buildings that are being transacted are in the 2 and 3 star category, between in the 1 and 5 star market categorization. So that, you know, what you're seeing happen is buildings being acquired and then rehabbed and then traditionally rented for higher rates. But no, we don't have an empirical link to say absolutely this is causing this, but that's where we're seeing the market transact.
So one strategic question, I guess, and this is where you kind of do this, but I'm not sure which is worse, getting to these major property owners now and saying this could be happening and let's partner on making the right thing happen, versus, yeah, but the minute you talk to them, they wait for, you know, somebody from Portland with a clipboard that's going to give us 3 times what its value. I'm trying to figure out, it feels like if we wait for another year, we don't have a program to offer them because we can't, it hasn't passed yet. But I'm worried about that hiatus where more of these transactions occur. And I don't know what the answer is, but are you guys talking about, maybe this is not your job, it's PDC's job, but how do we approach these property owners in a non-naive way, but say, you know, this is coming to a theater near you and we'd like to partner with you on doing the right thing, as opposed to waiting another year and some are gone and now I got you because I can get 4x for what I sell it today.
So we're not necessarily specifically focused on the corridor with the housing bond, but this is an area that we have been looking for properties, as well as some other key targets in the city. And we are also looking on the Division corridor, and some other, you can see by our map, we're trying to get some geographic diversity as well, which is one of our framework goals. I will tell you that we are actively seeking property, and it is, so are some of our other partners in affordable housing, and we are not yet having much luck. And it's kind of a universal concept. I'm not sure if it's what exactly that factor is. We're not looking for them to necessarily partner as much as sell it. If you're selling a property or considering,
give us a call. Yeah.
Give us a call, yeah. And they won't even necessarily know it's us when a broker contacts them. But we seem to be experiencing some kind of hold pattern, and I'm not sure what that relates to. I mean, I think we could all surmise that, but in my conversations with other jurisdictions who are actively seeking property, we are having some difficulty. And, you know, quite frankly, some of these are higher prices for units than what we see in other parts of the city as well. So,
right. Yeah, it's a tough one.
One idea, speaking from experience that we have around manufactured housing, is that it's been helpful for there to be an incentive for property owners to sell to a nonprofit or a public sector agency. So under state law, if you own a mobile home park and you sell it to a public agency or nonprofit, the state capital gains taxes are waived for the seller. And so I wonder if that might be something that the city of Portland could add to its legislative agenda for the legislature to consider extending that to other kinds of residential properties so that PHB or a nonprofit housing provider would have a leg up in making an offer and competing to buy a property because there's an incentive for the seller to sell to us instead of someone else.
Absolutely.
Thank you. I was sitting here thinking, well, you're not sure, that we have a small grant from Metro to really explore a business model for land banking, whether that be, again, internal to a public entity or a nonprofit. We're working with them and the national group to kind of look at models that have worked, because this question is just, it's a catch-22 around the value and holding on, and what would incent people to play with us. We sometimes get the edge because we're a nonprofit, people tip to do the right thing, but not if the money is significant enough to encourage them to go the other way. So we'll be a part of the team of people that kind of look at whether or not there's a best practice around this.
So moving to the next slide, you can see that there is, and I don't think this is a surprise to anyone sitting at this table, there's, particularly in Portland, not a substantial amount of affordable housing. And I'm going to go to the next slide because I think it's a better descriptor, given that a large volume of the city's affordable housing has been financed through urban renewal. Clearly is not urban renewal there, except potentially at the very beginning, if you're counting the South Waterfront. So there's very little existing regulated affordable housing. If you are looking at this compared to the city overall and therefore the region overall, so you can see that of the region's regulated affordable housing, 43% fall within a half mile of a MAX station, so within a walking distance to a light rail station. For the central city, that's in Portland, that's 17% of that total regulated housing, 24.4% outside the central city or within a half mile, and in the Southwest Corridor, if this is under the hypothetical that the light rail is already there, it would only be 1.2%. So a very small portion exists along the corridor and within walking distance of the light rail line. So with that, I'll turn over to Ryan to talk a little bit about process and how we got to a housing strategy for the corridor, and then we'll walk you through the strategy itself.
So, process. We did have an advisory group, and they have, as I said, been absorbed by the Metro's Southwest Equitable Development Strategy Oversight Committee, but the advisory group was highly engaged in the last 18 months, looking at our analysis and looking at a variety of different options for strategies to implement, and then helping us to kind of narrow that list down, which I'll share with you in a minute. We had an October launch where lots of community members came together, and the mayor of Portland, as well as Commissioner Tigard, came and kind of created some political opportunity for challenging other partners to kind of come to the table. So asking TriMet to look at a housing investment alongside the transit measure that they were looking at the time, and also setting aside and prioritizing any land from that they use for the construction of the light rail project to then later be reprioritized for affordable housing and discounting that. So those two asks created a lot of energy in the process, and I'll show you kind of how they landed. We engaged some of the community-based organizations that were in the advisory group we contracted with them to do some organizing in the corridor, specifically in some of those buildings that are those 2- and 3-star buildings that we analyzed. And so some of their solutions and priorities were integrated into the strategy. And as well, we hope that some of those relationships that those tenants have with their landlords could result in potential for acquisition. You never know how some of these opportunities could be sourced, but that is one potential way. the Community Alliance of Tenants kind of led that work with Opal and Unite and Muslim Educational Trust and Momentum Alliance, and the bulk of their work was around organizing Somali families predominantly to form a resident leadership cohort over about a 5-month period. They did a lot of training and education and priority setting, resulting in some proposed solutions that they submitted to community and to electeds on Mother's Day, May 13th. And you'll see some of those in the strategy. It was a great moment for them to advocate for their needs and to kind of step into that space. And they will hopefully will also continue that advocacy through the council process in October and also through implementation over the next 10 years. We hope that they continue that leadership. Oh wait, there they are. I forgot to skip ahead. So yeah, there's a picture of that leadership cohort. And you can look forward to, I think, some of them really stepping into different committee roles or advisory group roles over the next year. So that's one of their goals, was to get more involved in the planning processes. The next slide is just an overview, kind of high level, of what the components of the housing strategy are. The anti-displacement services and protections, I think, is the biggest difference between where we started and where we ended the process. Specifically, that is the result of the organizing work done by CAT and Opal and Unite. I think the emphasis on services and tenant protections just was not part of the initial scoping. It was more about securing land and looking at buildings and kind of regulated units, but this idea of clear tenant protections that would obviously have a citywide impact, as well as targeted anti-displacement services, which of course need a funding source, became a priority through their work. So the strategy itself was designed to achieve these three big goals. We'll sit with this slide for a second, kind of walk through these. The new resources is a question that was already raised earlier. The residential and cultural displacement became kind of the priority through the process, and then with an eye toward this kind of long-term new choice, new opportunity in this corridor that hasn't had a lot of development, especially affordable development. Those are the three big goals, and all pass it to Matt to talk about some of the resource tensions and opportunities that we surfaced, and you know, what are some of the asks that we're going to have of council.
So I'm going to talk about that a bit with the next slide. So this is a complicated but clear visual. This is a visual representation of the product of our conversations with the advisory committee and the conversations with the community. So it's talking about sequencing and staging the three large housing, the three goals and the strategies within each of the goals. And so in the first piece, the funding piece, you know, there is a general acknowledgement that there is not a dedicated source of resources for the housing strategy in Southwest Corridor. City Council's direction to PBOT and VPS, as Ryan said, was, well, if we're going to be considering the light rail line and a local preferred alternative, bring a housing strategy back. So we have developed one with the community and acknowledging that it will take resources to implement. We're working on costing that out right now before it goes to council. And so there's been discussions with Prosper Portland about a potential urban renewal area, acknowledging that money traditionally will come later in the process, that it would not be a good source of funding for some of our early strategies. So the advisory body and staff and the community all acknowledge that one of the most important things on the front end is the acquisition of buildings. And so that really needed to be prioritized. It is acquiring existing naturally occurring affordable housing, putting it into regulatory agreements to protect that affordability in the long term, either with short-term financing. This visual imagines short-term financing, an acquisition fund, with then permanent financing in some year, somewhere between 3 and 10 years, 5 and 10 years, so that those buildings can become permanently affordable. So that is a first priority, as well as putting in place regulatory protections, a lot of the tenant protections and services work. And that the land acquisition and the construction of new affordable housing is something that could be prioritized later as we got closer to the light rail going in to provide stability to existing tenants and new tenants. With those resources likely coming from, you know, potentially bond resources if the Metro bond passes, or the Housing Bureau is able to identify buildings with the Portland Housing Bond or some other sources of funding. But again, acknowledging that there isn't a dedicated source of funds currently in the corridor. I think that one of the big big emphasis, and I've already mentioned this, really is a request of the advisory body members of yes, do the regulatory elements now around tenant protections, but in the early years, focus on, again, that acquisition, stabilizing renters where they're at right now as much as possible, which requires early funding, and then transition into land development and new construction. Once you have acquired the existing buildings and you have a permanent source of financing for those buildings. So there's a lot of peer learning with Minneapolis-St. Paul and their acquisition fund. They were able to capitalize to acquire buildings in the short term. And then there's a question of, well, is there takeout financing, as I said, after 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years to make those buildings permanently, essentially permanently affordable. So this slide gives you a picture of some of the dollar amounts as well as some of the need. So this is a stretch target need. So it is not something we have the funding to support right now, but it is the targets that were set by the steering committee and agreed to as something that city council should actualize in the adoption of a strategy. So I'm going to focus on Portland again to try and the actual need, well, I'll focus on the corridor. I'm going to start with the graph on the right. The actual need is 4,240 homes. The stretch target is 2,300 homes. And a minimum target should be at least 1,000 homes. And so you can see there that if Portland, if we were to meet 41 to 55% of Portland's need, it would cost between $350 and $450 million total development costs. So not the traditional city subsidy, but the total development cost. And then for the city of Tigard, between $300 and $345 million. So I know Ryan has some remarks he wants to make on this as well, but just to acknowledge, this is an expensive undertaking. We don't currently have the resources, and we are working on figuring out what we have the potential to do with existing resources and what we would need new resources to implement. So.
Only to add that this is focused on affordable housing at 0 to 60% MFI for rental. That was where a lot of this focus was. We also have some market rate goals given the total growth anticipated over the next 10 years. So over 3,000 households moving in. If some of this new construction was affordable under these targets, that would still leave, you know, anywhere from around 1,700 market rate homes needing to be developed to meet the kind of projected growth, given what we assume will be the kind of the income ranges of new residents.
So
do those
targets correlate with the need that you had on the page earlier? The range of MFIs?
Yeah, they do.
They do. But they're all below, did you say below 60% for these?
Yes. So yeah, so that need page around the current and the future need,
yeah.
We took those numbers, put them together to make total need, and then kind of that's where you get that 4,200.
So you do have some below 80%.
We then also defined it as for a regulated, so there's assumptions and kind of in the logic model there, that for regulated affordable housing, we looked at the 0 to 60, and that some of the services and protections would meet partially some of the need of those with higher incomes. And also given, and that was also justified And you know, it's not a, that's not a perfect logic there.
Yeah,
but the analysis by PSU of the 2 and 3 star housing is that there, and also the CHAZ, the HUD data showed that the folks in the 50 to 80 MFI range, that is where there is a, and this is, I say with quotes, a surplus, that there are many of those units, but they're just unregulated and very fragile, but that currently there's some stock there. So if you had to make a priority, and we got this from the advisory group as well, it's emphasis on regulated affordable housing for those with lower incomes. So that's kind of how it all came together for these targets.
So maybe just the way this cat sees things, but this slide and the one before it, they need to be integrated a little more, because I grok what you're saying on page 15, but when I go to 16, I lose it, because I don't, first of all, I didn't get Matt's theme from that. For example, like the second column is really where your development's gonna happen, if I get you right. So some way of integrating those two I think would be helpful, because I see the detail in 15, but when I go to 16, it kind of disappears on me a little bit. So I don't know, it's just me, but. Also, just to point out a small fact, which is self-serving in the old days, the Community Housing Fund in Washington County does the same work that NOAA does, and so if you're outside Portland, i.e. Tigard and everything else in the corridor, that's another short-term pre-development land loan, five-year kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So hopefully, I love NOAA's work, but there are some other people doing the same work, CDFIs. There are other CDFIs in the community that could also, should also be giving that kind of funding to these deals. So there's another. And the other thing I was going to say is, when you start talking about market rate, I assume that's what the REIT is doing here, because if last time I talked to Sarah, they were looking at like 8 to 120 or something. Is that your take? They're not.
And then it goes to the question about the above 60% MFI, there is a tool in play that doesn't have a geographic specificity that,
right,
but could play a role.
Okay, but that's kind of where you're getting to, in the 80, 100, 120 area, that's your resource probably. Okay.
Is there a couple of places that mentions strengthening tenant protections?
Yeah.
Has there been any more thought into what those stronger protections would be?
Yeah, I alluded to it earlier that I was going to give you some specifics, and then it's not in here. So, but it is in the strategy, and I can forward you the actual document that the tenants submitted to their constituents and electeds on Mother's Day. They're very specific. There is some stuff around application fees being returned if applications aren't processed. Some support enforcing discrimination complaints. Mm-hmm. There was one around requirements that your income be three times the rent as a kind of a standard for TNN. Reform around that. Deposit reform. So it was, you know, and those are kind of the ones that got the most traction amongst the advisory group to end up in the strategy, and frankly, you know, support from within the bureaus to also include to work on together.
And there's a lot of conversation about parity between Tigard and Portland,
yeah.
And it was a real struggle for folks to, or just a challenge that Portland, while not a lot, is adopting some additional resident protections, and they're seeing that action, and they're seeing the potential for more in Portland, but you know, just further down the street in Tigard, they are not seeing similar action,
right?
And there are communities that cross those city boundaries and request for parity, either through action at the city council in Tigard or through the state legislature to make sure that the families along the corridor have the same level of protections and there's not a drop off in protections just because you cross the city border. So.
Has there been any sort of buy-in from Tigard City Council? I mean, I know that they haven't acted on this before, but it is a shared strategy and demand protections are called out, so I'm wondering if what the feasibility of the tenant protections aspect of the strategy is in Tigard. You can speak to that.
Sure. So we contracted mostly with CAT around their organizing and buildings, and Tigard contracted with United Oregon to do a lot of the organizing around the Ash Street alignment, because that was going to have direct displacement impact, or it could, though it's not preferred. And so there was a fair, it was four different meetings at St. Anthony's, and tenant protections was the thrust of the conversation. Tigard Council did adopt this strategy, or accepted, 4-1. 2 weeks ago, and tenant protections is the issue, you know, the kind of the nerve, the raw nerve. They're looking at 90-day notice around just cause, and then also bringing what's listed in the strategy. They are interested in bringing proposals forward. So the ones I just kind of listed off, those are written down, and staff told their council they will be bringing those forward. And so you just don't know at the time that they bring those forth, whether they'll be received or not, but the intent is to do so. And CAT and Unite staff have been doing a lot of education and engagement with Tigard staff and elected. So the last 18 months, I've seen a shift in the willingness to even talk about the issues. Mm-hmm. And it was driven by the organizing. You know, it wasn't us as jurisdictional partners saying, catch up. It was really driven by the community organizing, the community voice, which is testimony to like put some dollars into that and good things can come. Which is one of our challenges.
Could I?
It's the last challenge, so we'll start with the other ones first. But if there are more questions before we dive into how hard this is going to be.
Yeah, just before we move off of the tenant protection side, thinking about the buildings, other buildings in Portland that we've seen change hands, investors buying up the, kind of naturally occurring affordable housing. We heard at this committee, we heard from tenants at the Holgate Manor a couple of months ago, and talked a little bit at that meeting about the idea of an advance notice requirement for a landlord that's going to sell a building, and that notice could go to both the renters and the public agencies that have bond dollars that could be spent to buy those buildings, and that could really give us a leg up to try to do some acquisition before the buildings hit the open market. So I would suggest that concept get tossed into the hopper on potential policy tools that could help us, really practically get notice of when these buildings are being considered for sale and kind of a chance to buy them before they go to an outside investor.
Yeah, to Shannon's point earlier about transactions on the market, brokers are only a small part of the transactions that we went back and looked at. A lot of this is just off market, private sales.
Right.
There could be
a policy, and the same exists for mobile home parks, that if the owner wants to sell, they have to give advance written notice to the tenants, and we could require that also go to the city or to Metro or whoever's controlling the bond dollars, and say there's a waiting period that you have to tell us that you're going to sell the building before you could transact a sale. It's been done in other jurisdictions, and something that could be helpful in this sort of situation where we're proactively saying we want to get buildings off the market and preserve them, but we're not getting word about these off-market sales that are happening.
Competing priorities?
Oh, yes. So I think one other thing that's been present, which is I think also particularly relevant to Portland and this group and the Bureau, I think for Tigard, this is a big part of their downtown development work and a very focal point in the city, and that's not to say that the Southwest Corridor is not important in the city of Portland, but it is definitely one area of Portland, and we have competing limited resources and competing priorities around the city. So we have housing work and housing commitments we've made in North and Northeast Portland, in East Portland, along the Division Corridor. We're going to council tomorrow. commitments that are not geographic, or Thursday. We have commitments that aren't geographically specific around permanent supportive housing and successful implementation of the bond, which has its own policy framework about geographic distribution of resources. So that's, you know, just to name a few. You know, we are working on bringing a strategy back to City Council for when they consider before they consider the locally preferred alternative vote around the actual light rail line, and to be very transparent about the resources we do have in the Southwest Corridor, the commitments we have elsewhere, and then what we can actually afford, and what resources the Bureau would need to actually implement the strategy itself in the time frame that's imagined, which is again ahead of the actual beginning of the construction of the light rail, and then the completion and the opening of the light rail line, should that move forward. So it is, you all are well aware of our limited resources and our competing priorities, but that's something that we're working right now, both within the Housing Bureau, and then we'll work with BPS on coming into a work session with City Council in September to really be very candid and honest to say, you know, we're not putting this in front of you and saying, we can do this. We're saying this is what, through a process, the community and the city have identified as the need, and this is where our existing resources are, here's where our existing commitments are, and here's what it would take to fund. I think it'll be a sobering conversation. So. And then uncertainty of the light rail, but nobody knows if that's actually going to happen. But that's on our side, outside of the uncertainty of the light rail, on our side, that's the competing priorities, and the need for immediate funding is one of the, going to be one of the biggest challenges we're going to have to wrestle with.
Guys, how realistic is the urban renewal option? Even, and I get that it's down the road, but in order, I mean, we're only talking about a percentage of the need and the challenges. What are the chances for that?
I don't know how to quantify the chances, but I
wanted the exact percentage.
72.5%. Okay. Prosper Portland has been very active in these discussions. They've also been very clear that their priorities right now are commitments made in some other areas of the city, particularly East Portland, that would be the priority for a next some sort of urban renewal area, but that they do seem open to considering an urban renewal area in the Southwest Corridor if a light rail line goes in. I don't think that they are interested in using the, they want to use the funds for anti-displacement and community stabilization, community development, not light rail. I want to be clear about that. They have been actively participating. Obviously, no decisions have been made, and eventually it will be a council decision. But they also, you know, have been clear that it will need to get in line with their commitments in some other parts of the city.
Yeah, I would just add that it's one of the bigger recommendations, but it's one of the ones most dependent on the light rail happening.
Oh, yeah, and they won't happen without the light rail.
So the other piece I wanted to make sure you understood was that capitalization was the biggest thing that was going to indicate that this was going to be different this time, that we weren't, there was not going to be any bait and switch, we were going to overpromise and underdeliver, we were going to do what we could, and the more funds available, the more we could do, and just calibrate it that way. The other big one is whether the community organizations that are now very active in the corridor and have a constituency they've organized can continue through implementation and play a role in accountability and reporting and the implementation of those services and protections. So that is something that we're crafting a proposal for council and both Tiger and Portland to support and want to continue that relationship with those organizations that are down there and are committed to the long term. And so the reporting of kind of our progress of the strategy would be a role for them as well, and we do that together, but this is not a competition that just happens in October and then there's either, you know, there's no follow-up. And then we want to keep this conversation fresh every year.
I wasn't directly or personally involved. I know a lot of people put a ton of time and effort and energy into the Albina community plan, and maybe Maxine and others back that many years ago. I think UrbanLink was directly involved. We might benefit from some lessons learned about some of the policies that did survive and ones that were just swept over. Just as a kind of way to see whether or not we can apply some lessons learned to this, because people were told the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. Stay active, stay involved, we'll be held, we'll, you know, you can hold us accountable, mm-hmm. and it's just simply not what happened.
Again, it goes back to resources. It was not just, do we have a seat at the table, but are we resourced to even just set the table ourselves? And I think that's the ask that we're putting forth. And then it's an ask we're doing, you know, we will take to philanthropy and take to the other, Metro and others over the long term, but we want to at least get it off the ground as the city who started the conversation.
Well, and maybe it's a statement of the obvious, but one of the things that's presented is the immediate threat of another displacement experience being put in competition with trying to cure a past displacement disaster. And that's going to be a very hard call, because 5 years from now we may be trying to cure what we didn't prevent in Southwest Corridor the same way we're doing it in North Northeast. So those choices are going to be hard for electeds, but the reality is, this is, you know, we've done this with light rail two or three times, and months ago some of us asked on that committee, what do we learn from the Orange Line? And the answer was, we don't know. Mm-hmm. We do know what we learned from the Yellow Line, but it just strikes me that here we are discussing early on, well, it's probably not even early on, 4 years ago would have been maybe timely, but we're dealing with the threat of another displacement experience at the same time we've committed to trying to cure a past displacement experience. And I don't know which way that you go there, but it's a real tension, I think, from a policy perspective, of whether we prevent another problem at the expense of someone else. That's the displacement issue here is a real tough one, I think, for whoever's going to have to do this balance. And commitments are commitments, I get that. But I don't know. It's a tough call, I really think.
I have a question on the strategies. On the row, I'm looking at the sequencing page, The row that says acquire land and develop. Can you say more about the Affordable Housing Memorandum of Understanding, what that is?
So this is... So, generally, it is the city's memorandum of understanding with TriMet, but I would say more broadly, it applies to all public land. There's the potential for, we're in discussions with TriMet right now around a MOU specific to the disposition of land that will be acquired for the development of the light rail line itself, mm-hmm. and the use of that land. So establishing clear agreements about the number of sites that are used for affordable housing along the corridor. But I think you could also, when you start looking at seeing PCC parking lot and TriMet ODOT city-owned properties, there will be other potential public properties that the city could develop itself, or that may be a large enough area that we could do some sort of disposition and development agreement with a private developer to get additional public benefits. So I think while this is generally speaking to the Metro, TriMet, City of Portland, City of Tigard, and Washington County IGA for the light rail specific land and the commitments from all those agencies, you can broaden that to say all of this potential public land and disposition of land, the public benefits that are gained from either the for-profit or non-profit development of that land.
it would be great to fold into that same approach an inventory of property not only that's owned by a public agency, but owned by faith communities or other property owners that might have some kind of mission motivation for collaborating on affordable housing in that area, so, just to see if there's some kind of low-hanging fruit for getting property secured beyond just what's already in the public sector.
Yeah, if you, when you look at, I didn't mention this, but when you're looking at some of the targets, I think it's the stretch targets, because there's a question, well, how did you get to the stretch target number? It was this idea that it's, that the goal should be, and it's in the full strategy, we acquire 10 buildings and we build 10 new buildings. Mm-hmm. And so the building the 10 new buildings requires sites for us to build on them.
Yeah.
And so that sort of roughly gets you to around 2,300 in the stretch target, which is what we want to capitalize toward. But to that point, that's what we do need some land, and we're hoping for some of it from public land, but some of it could be from mission-driven organizations as well.
Thanks.
Great, thank you, Ryan.
Thanks, Ryan.
Before we wrap up here, it looks like we will be finished a few minutes early. It does look like we've had someone sign up for public testimony. So if you go ahead, like to go ahead and come on up.
Veronica, are you coming?
I'm right here. First, I was at a party, somewhere else. Was a good place right there?
That's perfect.
Okay, good.
And then just hit the blue button.
Blue button? Oh, like that. We're live. We are live. Good. August the 7th, and we are live. Good. My name is Veronica Bernier from PSU Public Health. And our group is working on housing. And as a volunteer member of Portland Housing Advisory Committee for about probably over 10 years, I've noticed lots of changes coming down the pike, so to speak. But I just wanted to bring something up. I commend you for your work on bringing together all these proposals towards public housing. I think that you're going in the right direction, and being inclusive is very important. It's always been a challenge to those of us in public health to include people who have migrated over to our community from other lands and incorporate them into housing. And I think seeing them, having the ability to see the people, is really important. Also, just one other note, we have had some problems in the Southeast and Northeast, and sometimes in the West, of things like little kind of wildfires in July and August, because it's hot and because people, you know, drink a lot and all that stuff. Sometimes backyard parties get a little out of hand. And I just want to commend the police department for joining some of those parties and trying to meet the people at their own level. Right now, we're challenged with the homeless on the street, the tents, camping, and all that stuff, and the Dignity Village and the tiny trailers for one, and all that. Also, some of the mobile home issues to incorporate the homeless. Right now, it's hard for them to save money. We know that, and being employed does help. You know, once they get a job, they are on the way, and that's very, very important. I'm retired MIC nurse, and so I kind of like am out of that loop, but I understand some of the issues. The biggest issue coming down the pipe right now is the factor of the hidden factor. And the hidden factor is that unseen manipulator of people's minds. And what we're seeing right now is that the teens and the young kids, like K through 12, are being manipulated by hidden factors. And I just want to say kudos to the Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts and 4-H and the Interfaith Council for standing up to that challenge. The teen challenge of today is so important. Just remember to include them outside in together on the edge is really important. We want to support that too. And support our local zoo too. We're blessed with having a zoo. That's really, really important. And I think that, you know, people come and go. They do move out of the city, hopefully to greener pastures, and that's good too. One of the things we do, just to wrap this up real quick, is go out and check all the ALFs, assisted living facilities, and other HUD properties just to make sure they're well maintained, and that's part of our work as public health people and public health nurses. School health and safety remains way high in our minds, and so we want to support that and keep continuing to walk that walk. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks, Veronica.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, and with that, we are adjourned.
Can I sit for a few minutes?
Yes, that's totally fine.